And gentlemen, this is one of the two panels taking place right now. And it's a panel in which I have a particular, with my wife, degree of pride. The reason's quite obvious, or maybe not to all of you. This panel has David Keyes, who will be speaking first. We got to David through one of the honorary co-chair, Erwin Cutler, who has been my friend for over 50 years. Oscar Morales, we got to through a young leader from 2010. And Thailand is the first young leader, together with one of her cohorts in the other panel, who will be speaking on a major panel in the same year in which she is a young leader. That is exactly what we are trying to accomplish. They are the personalities who have made it possible. And we thank you all for being here and for doing it. The bios are in the programs. I don't want to take time reading them. Thailand has come in last minute replacing Rosabelle from Uganda, who could not make it. The second thing I want to do is just give you one little bit of an observation of my own. We've had 4.5 days with the young leaders. We've had 3 days of these panels. What has struck me about the panels is that there is a lot of politics and a lot of theory. But in the end, there hasn't been that hardcore, what do we do with this problem today? In some regards, we got that more out of the young leaders. Personally, I believe, as the speaker of the last panel said, human rights is more important than democracy, because you do not have democracy without human rights. And when human rights become frail, democracy becomes frail, and there your freedoms become frail. It's not more complicated than that. And the place that we should start is looking in the mirror individually. Because the person who looks back to you is the person over which you have the greatest control, the person who you influence the most. And societies are collections of individuals. And societies also have to start by looking into the mirror, starting with themselves. In both cases, depending on the level of that society, they have to look outward, what they can do, how they can help, what they can contribute. That's what this conference is about. The people who are going to bring it about are not my generation. They're going to use technologies that I am, in many regards, incapable of using. But because I have gray hair, because I have lines on my face, I probably understand the consequences of their use as well as they do. They are tomorrow. Their technologies will allow people to, who have looked into the mirror, see, and societies who have looked in the mirror, see what they can do for others, how they can spread human rights, how they can enforce human rights, and how they can protect human rights. And these are the people who will use those technologies that will make a difference. And I will leave you with one last thing. Someone reminded me in our first conference in 2007, we used to have stacks of faxes. There was only one or two computers on the desks at the Young Leaders Program. No faxes, emails, everybody's holding a computer, and if they're not holding a computer, they're having an iPhone. If they don't have an iPhone, they have an iPad. Times have changed. Those times can be an asset to what we are trying to do. So with that not so short introduction, if my wife's here, I apologize. I'd like to call on David, who, as I said, came to us through his good friend and my good friend, and this conference honorary chair, Erwin Cutler. David?
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, and it's delightful to be in Montreal for the first time. I co-founded a group called cyberdissidents.org when I worked for Natan Sharansky, the great Soviet dissident. And about 3 years ago, I joined together with Bob Bernstein, the founder of Human Rights Watch, to create a new group, and most of our work is supporting online activists in closed societies. So with the few minutes I have, I'd like to give you a glimpse into that world, into the potential of online activists to help forge the future, to help shape new societies, and the role of the West particularly to help them. So I'd like to take you back to January 25th, 2011, when Secretary of State Clinton was asked what the assessment of Egypt was in the eyes of the United States government. She said the following, quote, "Our assessment is that the Egyptian government is stable." Shortly thereafter, of course, we know what happened. Mubarak fell. The entire regime was overthrown. Right. And I remember when I first heard it, I was flabbergasted. And the next day, I was asked by a journalist, what should President Obama do in Egypt? And I said, the very first thing he should do is to tell Secretary of State Clinton not to talk about how stable Egypt is, because it's not. I didn't have any access to secret information. But I did spend some time in the Islamist slums of Cairo. And it was in a cafe in Cairo when I was speaking with a friend of mine where I started to talk about Hosni Mubarak. And he looked at me with terror in his eyes and he said to me in Arabic, "Il-hitan li hawivan," the walls have ears. Don't talk here. And that was the first taste I had of a closed society, of a fear society, and what it meant to live in a place where you couldn't even speak freely about the leadership. And I knew inherently from reading Sharansky how unstable those countries were. At the same time, I saw another aspect of Egypt, and that was the young bloggers, the young online activists, who were the most brazen in their critique of Mubarak. And this was an experience that I saw over and over again in different countries throughout the Middle East. And so when I saw in 2009 that Newsweek had called Bashar al-Assad an enlightened leader and that a wise, benevolent dictator was the best method of development in that country, I couldn't but laugh. And when I heard a scholar at the Council on Foreign Relations say that Tunisia was the most stable country in the Middle East, that his colleagues, many of whom thought the same thing, a fruit vendor immolates himself, and shortly thereafter, the country falls. And I couldn't help laugh at the assessment of State Department officials who would refer to Egypt as the anchor of stability in the Middle East, the Mubarak regime as an island of stability, and so on and so forth. And I think that the key link that I understood from Sharansky and Sakharov and other great Soviet dissidents is the link between internal freedom and external peace, between internal freedom and external stability. Avital Sharansky, who was Natan's is Natan's wife and helped release him from prison, tells an anecdote where she's standing at the State Department in front of a huge map of the world, and an official turns to her and said, "You don't really expect us to relegate all of the important geostrategic challenges of our time to the release of your husband, do you?" And she said, "What you don't understand is that those issues won't be resolved until my husband is free." And she understood with total clarity the link between internal freedom and external stability. So I thought about how we could help those individual dissidents, particularly those cyber activists who were on the front line of the fight against dictatorship throughout the world, what role the West could play. And it seemed to me at the time that the best thing that the West can do is to stand firmly behind them, to be their greatest allies, to give them political support, at times to give them economic support, but for them to always know that we are on their side. And so I'd like to read you a brief quote, again about the Soviet period, and then I'll turn it more towards today's cyber dissidents. Sharansky writes, "In 1986, the Soviet dissident Anatoly Marchenko died in the infamous Chistopol prison after a long and futile hunger strike for improved conditions. 3 years earlier, I had gone on a similar hunger strike in the same prison and had been subjected to the same torturous conditions by KGB thugs. But the authorities eventually gave in to my demands. Why? Because my 9 years of imprisonment were accompanied by a relentless worldwide campaign and steady, unambiguous pressure on the communist regime by leaders of the free world. The regime knew it would pay a heavy price if I were to die. With Marchenko, it was confident that the world did not care enough to do much more than mount a formal protest." That sounds good. It sounds nice. It makes you feel warm inside. But do we actually know that that kind of sustained pressure on a dictatorship for an individual dissident can have an impact? The answer to that is yes, and it comes to us through way of an anecdote as told by my mentor, Erwin Kotler, who in 1997 was honored at a dinner with Mikhail Gorbachev. And he walked up to him and he said, "Mr. Gorbachev, I was Sharansky's lawyer. I'd like to know why you, after 9 years, decided to let him out of prison." And speaking through a translator, this is what he said verbatim. Gorbachev, quote, "I never knew anything about Sharansky. I never even knew the name. I came to Canada. as the Minister of Agriculture and appeared before a Canadian Parliamentary Committee on Agriculture. But instead of getting questions about agriculture, I got questions about Sharansky. I left the Parliament building and saw placards of Sharansky. Wherever I went, I was confronted by Sharansky. So I came back to the Soviet Union and I said, who is this guy, Sharansky? I got the files and said, well, he might have been a troublemaker, but he isn't a criminal. And so we ordered his release. It was costing us to keep him in prison. It was in our national interest to let him go. It's a rather remarkable anecdote to hear the leader of the Soviet Union, a nuclear superpower, say that it was placards outside of the Canadian Parliament that helped influence his decision to release Sharansky and to keep up the pressure to release other Soviet dissidents. This applies very well to today's cyber activists, and particularly in the Middle East, the region that I've studied. Ahmed Batabi, who spent 10 years in Iranian prison, when he first went before the judge held up a picture of him on the cover of The Economist magazine, a famous white bloodied shirt in 1999 that he was holding up in protests in Iran. And the judge said, with this picture, you have signed your own death warrant. And it took Batabi 10 years in prison, and when he got out, he said, in fact, that picture was the only thing that kept me alive. And so I think the more focus that we can bring to individual activists, the safer we can keep them and the more sustained pressure we can keep on autocratic regimes. But that requires us to know their stories, their individual stories, to individualize the dissident experience. I spoke at Google not long ago to a group of cyber activists from the Middle East, and I said, with all due respect, you have immense power, but you haven't succeeded in telling your narrative to Western publics in a way that remains in their minds. Your names are not known by Western societies, and until that happens, they won't care sufficiently to back you. We must know their names. It's not just theory, it's also practice. There's a fascinating professor from University of Oregon that had three test groups in front of him, and he gave one test group facts about millions of people starving in Africa, and the second test group got a picture of an individual 7-year-old starving in Africa. And the third test group got an individual 7-year-old girl and a 7-year-old boy who were starving in Africa. And on average, people gave twice as much money when confronted with a single face as opposed to the facts about the millions of people suffering. Interestingly enough, the decline in giving began with the addition of that second person. So the Soviets might not have had the same technology that we have today, but their names, Sakharov, Sharansky, Bukovsky, Amalric, Marchenko, were known, and all they had was samizdat, underground literature passed from one person to another, in tiny amounts. There was a study done that showed that between 1950 and 1975, a total of 1,500 pieces of samizdat made it to the West. Nowadays, think about the amount of literature, the amount of poetry, the amount of art that's produced per second that's gotten out on Twitter and Facebook, and indeed, it is overwhelming. And I think that's why these individual activists have to learn to tell their stories in a different way, namely by highlighting the individuals behind the struggle, even at times more than the causes. And I think Oscar did an amazing job at organizing people on Facebook, which you'll hear about soon. And so I'll just close with two short recommendations, practical recommendations of how we can help online activists and those who I see as on the front line against dictatorship. The first is to bring up their names in bilateral meetings, high-level bilateral meetings with autocratic countries. I was told by the man who was in charge of bilateral arms negotiations with the Soviets in the 80s that in every single meeting with his counterparts, he said, we cannot trust you because you violate the Helsinki Final Act through your treatment of Sharansky, Sakharov, and Yuri Orlov. I met a man who was on the first trade delegation to Libya from the United States in decades, and I asked him what his opinion was of Fatih Jahami, the most famous Libyan dissident. And he looked at me and he said, who is that? He didn't even know the name of the most famous Libyan dissident to the country that he was going to. So I think a lot more sustained pressure can be brought simply by raising the names of imprisoned online activists, people like Hamza Khashoggi in Saudi Arabia, who have been in prison now for more than a year merely for writing a few tweets questioning religion. In the Palestinian Authority, a man named Anas Awad was just given a 1-year sentence for posting a picture of President Abbas. Senator Kirk and Erwin Kotler indeed deserve special recognition because they are really on the forefront of doing exactly this. I've been on conference calls with Senator Kirk and Egyptian dissidents recently out of prison. And in one of them, Senator Kirk said, I want anyone who's listening to this phone call to know that Karim Amer is extremely influential in the United States Senate. He said with the presumption that the Mukhabarat secret police were listening. The second idea is linkage, linking human rights to foreign aid, and particularly online rights and freedom of expression. Scoop Jackson famously tied most favored nation status in the 1970s to the right of free emigration. I'd like to read just one quote from Scoop Jackson. He said, "We Americans are fortunate to have at our service the greatest economy the world has ever known. It can do more than enrich our lives. It can be pressed into service as an instrument of our commitment to individual liberty." There are so many instances where this can be used, and it's not. I think of Khalid Johani or, again, Hamza Kashgari, lots of individuals in Saudi Arabia. Just the other week, one of the most famous human rights activists, Mohammed Ghahtani, was imprisoned, and at the same time, Western countries are sending tens of billions of dollars of arms to this theocratic, gender apartheid, repressive, discriminatory dictatorship. And so I'll just close by saying that I think if we stay true to the following three principles, we will do a lot to advance human liberty, and especially as it relates to freedom of expression and the Internet. The first is we must trust states as only as much as they trust their own people. If you want to know how well a country is going to uphold international peace and security, look at how they treat their bloggers. Look at how they treat their online activists. If they're in prison, if they're fearful, it does not look good on the international scene as well. The second is that the Sakharov principle, that in the end, the moral choice ends up being the most pragmatic choice. There are many decisions that have to be made by Western countries, and in briefings with government officials, we face this a lot, where there are realpolitik reasons not to do the right thing. But I think in the case of Sharansky and so many dissidents, oftentimes the pressure that's galvanized by the West to put the focus on an individual and to prioritize human rights, in fact, has a truly wonderful effect on the international scene as well. And the last principle is that we must fear tyranny more than anarchy and prize liberty over stability. I think if we stay true to those principles, human rights will be helped, as will international peace and security. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Now you'll understand what I meant when I said young leaders look into the mirror and they see themselves and do something. He looked into the mirror and he saw what his society or other societies are doing or can do. He has. That is the practical implementation of human rights. I use that as a segue into having just met Thailand, a 2013 young leader. But a 2013 young leader who has already started a grassroots operation in England, who is going effectively international with it.
Already is.
I didn't read that part, but I should have. The point that I'm making is here is tomorrow using a technology that we of yesterday, including Erwin and I, have very little understanding on how to use, but we do know the consequences of it. Tarlin, please.
Well, thank you very much. It is a great privilege and honor to be speaking alongside Oscar Morales and David Keyes today in discussing borderless technology and new movements in social change. As you already know, Rosebell from Uganda was unable to make it today due to visa problems, but it is a great honor for me to speak to you as a fellow young leader of the McGill Eckenberg Fellowship and be asked by the organizers to fill her shoes. So I definitely want to say thank you to Gordon and the people at McGill University for giving me this opportunity and to represent the 2013 young leaders today. I'm a 26-year-old diplomatic consultant who started my own company, Grassroot Diplomat, from scratch. And as someone who's grown up in the internet age, I can't even begin to tell you how important the internet and social media has been in my personal and professional development. Socializing, discussing, transacting, mobilizing, and working in this dimension are quite simply a normal, everyday tool that we use in our lives. And this is evident for young people all over the world today. And unlike Oscar and David, particularly to Oscar, who has used social media for social change, I think it is important to acknowledge the dangers of abusing freedom of speech in an open world where your message can be read by anybody in any country in all over the world in an instant. It can be misinterpreted and it could be felt by a real human being with real feelings. Cyberspace, for all the possibilities that it offers, is at the end of the day nothing more than technology serving the needs of real human beings. And the context, while the contexts are virtual, the people behind them are real. And on the internet, everything we post, everything we read is done anonymously. So the consequences of one's actions for other people are not immediately apparent. And with the click of a button, your message can be sent instantly across thousands and hundreds of people around the world. But this is not a reason to accept that anything goes. And it is not a reason to allow this medium to be misused to violate human rights and people's dignity of others, or to even put them at real risk in their real life. So what I want to talk to you about today is online hate speech and using the internet as a tool. There is a fine line between hate speech and freedom of speech. And this opens up dangers of violating human rights and dignity, particularly when hate speech is directed at someone's religion, race, sexual orientation, and religion. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that everyone has the freedom of opinion and expression, and this right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of frontiers. So freedom of expression is fundamental for every democratic society, and the free exchange of ideas and vibrant public debate are the lifeblood of any democracy. Freedom of expression is guaranteed by international standards, and in Europe, this protection is enshrined in Article 10 of the European Convention on Human Rights and its case laws, which remains the main reference points when seeking a good balance between freedom of speech and hate speech. But laws should not be the only way to protect human rights online, and it doesn't always resolve the hurt and pain that somebody feels and silently endures by the hateful messages that they receive online. So the internet has changed the way we communicate, and it is very easy for us to add comments online when we have an initial gut reaction about something we have read in less than 10 seconds. And the average Facebook and Twitter users spend less than 10 seconds to think before publicly publishing their comments online, and then they forget about it and move on and do something else. So it's very simple and it's very easy, and that's one of the reasons why social media is so popular and people are able to use it so easily. But one negative comment, just one negative comment, can turn into hate speech, especially when your comments are offending. And even if you're not writing a comment to intentionally offend someone, the fact is, even unintentionally, you are hurting someone with what you're writing online. And this is particularly dangerous because on the internet, there is no way of telling the tone of language that you're using. So even though you're using or saying something humorously, it can be depicted and misinterpreted anyway. So the internet has made people feel more empowered to be far more insulting online because you're communicating anonymously through an open meeting than you would do in person. And unfortunately, this is a reality. So just to clarify what I mean by hate speech, I do want to go through definitions so I don't have any criticism afterwards. So I would define hate speech as bias-motivated, hostile, malicious speech aimed at a person or a group of people because of their actual or perceived innate characteristics. Hate speech expressed discriminatory, intimidating, disapproving, antagonistic, prejudiced attitudes towards those characteristics, which include gender, race, ethnicity, color, national origin, disability, or sexual orientation. Hate speech is intended to injure, dehumanize, harass, intimidate, debase, degrade, and victimize the targeted groups, and to foment insensitivity and brutality against them. So the problem with social media and online communication is that once a comment or a tweet has been published, it has the potential to go viral, even after the comment is taken down. And I was very shocked when I was researching this topic to see the following Twitter feeds directed at President Barack Obama when he was re-elected as president for the second time. And this is a blatant example of racist online hate speech. And I kindly ask you to read this in silence because it is quite offensive. And please pay close attention to the number of retweets and favorites made by other users here. So these comments are obnoxious, very, very offensive, and the sad reality is hate speech online is not the work of lonely lunatics and individuals who have nothing better to do, but they are people like us who are well-educated and pretty much just abuse their own freedom of speech. So the fine line between freedom of speech and hate speech is your rights end where mine begin, and the violation of human rights is easily done in an anonymous space. And in racism in social media news, Facebook has refused to remove this picture of a black monkey and a white baby with the caption, "Stop racism, black children and white children are the same." And the photo appears on the page, laughing so hard you feel a six-pack coming on. And this has caused a maelstrom of controversy, leading to a petition created by change.org demanding that Facebook remove this offensive language. Unfortunately, when users reported this to Facebook, this was the official message from them. "Thank you for your report. We have carefully reviewed the photo you reported and found that it doesn't violate our community standard on hate speech, so we didn't remove it." And this picture is still up on Facebook and hasn't been removed. And to date, the photo has received 335 comments, 2,958 likes, and 237 shares. Facebook has a policy implemented to not allow hate speech on their forum, but apparently portraying black children as monkeys doesn't violate the human rights online. I know I'm running out of time, but I just want to quickly give you an example of hate speech affected by people. This is a journalist. His name is Mehdi Hassan, and he is a British political journalist who writes for The Guardian newspaper and New Statesman political magazine. And as one of the few Muslim columnists in Britain, Mehdi writes about Islamophobia and the treatment of British Asian ethnic minorities in the UK. And as a consequence of his articles, a racist smear campaign was started by online users that personally attacked Mehdi on both The Guardian and New Statesman websites. And many of them have written about him in their own blogs and targeting and vilifying him for speaking out his mind. And in his article that he published, Mehdi wrote, Have you ever been called an Islamist? How about a jihadist or a terrorist? Extremist, maybe? Welcome to my world. It's pretty depressing. Every morning, I take a deep breath, and then I go online to discover what new insult or smear has been thrown at my direction. Whether it's tweets, blog posts, or comment threads, the abuse is as relentless as it is vicious. You might think that I've become used to it by now. Well, I haven't. And when I started writing for a living, I never imagined I'd be a victim of such Islamophobic attacks on a near daily basis. So, no matter how carefully you choose your words online, it seems that as a Muslim and as a member of an ethnic minority in the UK, it's almost impossible to write about a political topic without being accused of being an Islamist or a supporter of extremist parties or even a mouthpiece for the Muslim Brotherhood. Second example is, again, another British journalist. Her name is Nadia Takolia, a Muslim third-generation ethnic minority in the UK. And she wrote an article about the hijab from a feminist point of view and received more than thousands of online comments, mostly driven by commonly held stereotypes. And she received comments right at the bottom that were directly racist, such as, "Sorry you hate our country, Google Heathrow, Gatwick, etc., and go home." But, you know, England is our home. She's been there. She was born there. Her family have been there for three generations. This is her home, no matter what her ethnic, origin of ethnicity is. And some people just don't understand that immigration is a part of culture now, and you need to accept that just because she's a different color doesn't mean that she doesn't belong in this society. And Muslims are Britain's largest religious minority group, and for many British Muslims who have either Pakistani or Bangladeshi origin, religion is a part of their cultural identity. That has embedded racial traits. And the online intolerance that these journalists have experienced is often unleashed on racial minority, regardless of the religion, and this is the reality for many ethnic minorities in Europe across the board. So the victims of hate speech online are real. They are suffering mentally and often physically. It is often commonplace for women, young boys, and young girls online to be hounded, abused, and threatened with rape. And this is dangerous. And a climate of hate on the internet translates into a climate of hate, discrimination, and violence in society that shouldn't be tolerated, not in person and not online. And we must not leave cyberspace in the hands of those who want to manipulate it and abuse it. And some people may feel that there is less of a barrier of making hateful statements in the relative anonymity?
Anonymity.
Yeah, thank you. of cyberspace and less, you know, than in face-to-face conversation. And they shouldn't. And preventing and challenging hate speech whenever and wherever it occurs is about our decency as human beings. So hate speech online reflects a larger phenomenon. It's a loss of respect for each other, and it is a loss of civility and citizenship. Human rights and democracy cannot be protected by legal means alone. Hate speech is not only about being politically correct, it is about living up to our responsibilities and standing up and speaking out when hate speech is delivered to a fellow human being. Sensitivity is not a sign of weakness. And as human beings, we must all remember that behind our words is the power to hurt as well as the power to empower. And although we are entitled to our own opinions, it should never be our intention to hurt someone intentionally or otherwise. So I would like to end my presentation with a short exercise to remind us of our rights and dignity as human beings. And I kindly ask that everyone stands up. And what we will do is, using our own mother tongue, our own language, and in unison, I want everyone to say, "My name is, I am from, and I will not hate," in your own language, in unison. So when I count to 3, 2, 1, we'll say it together. So 3, 2, 1. My name is Tarlene. I am from the UK.
And
I will not hate. Thank you very much.
Literally showed us why Penny and I in the center have such faith in the young leaders that we've had. And she did that when she made her presentation. She ended her presentation with that same thing. And it was an incredible thing to see 25 young leaders get up from 21 countries and make that statement. It was rewarding. Technology can be used positively or negatively. Technology is power. So is political power.
Oops, sorry.
I just said, technology is power.
I told you I was technically incompetent.
I can't wait to get home and hear what my children are going to tell me. Little my wife who just came in. You'd be here for that part, wouldn't you? Anyway. Power is technology. Political power is a form of power. It's neither good nor bad, right nor wrong. It hasn't got an up or a down or a left or a right. Power is how you use it. Oscar Morales used the power of technology to amass probably the largest army of Facebook users, I think, in history. 12 million Facebook users joined as a result of Oscar's efforts to deal with FARC in Colombia. Oscar, please tell your story.
FARC as a terrorist organization, just very similar like Al-Qaeda, only that they didn't do a 9/11. They've been doing it ever since 1964 in quota, in those by years and years of attacks and after attacks. But kidnapping in the year 2006, around 2006, became critical. FARC had more than 3,000 people in captivity, ranging from soldiers, from politicians, from farmers, from anybody they could trap because they had a value, like they had a political value. But among them, there was a kid, Emmanuel, that was only 4, and Emmanuel had been, was born in captivity. His mother was the one kidnapped. So when he was 4, the entire country knew about him, but we never knew about his whereabouts. So in January 1, 2008, news came presented by the president of our nation that they found him and that he was very ill and almost dead. So that information really raged the country because for the first time we had the face of a victim that was inexplicable. Not that we agree that they kidnap any human being, but that face of that child really broke us. So that fuel of rage, in a matter of a month, gave us the opportunity to call for a protest. And the message was so clear. What we did was to not call for these, you know, romantic titles like, "Let's march for peace." No, this time we were really dealing with a huge deal. This organization, for 40 years, they were killing us and killing us and killing us, and nobody dared to say something. Actually, governments, what they're trying to do was to negotiate. like if freedom could be negotiated. Freedom is just freedom, right? So what I said, what I did was to go online and to find out if somebody was screaming the same way I was wanting to do, and I found nothing because of fear. Because these terrorists are so dangerous that actually what they did to our society was to shut us up. And I was then determined to say, they won't shut me up. I feel that I have so much fuel that I broke the fear. I made a campaign online to fight them from within civil society without a weapon, just using our voice. That was the message. And apparently people liked the message and they joined us, and the traditional media joined us. It was a magical story of how to combine social media with what's already in place, with the outlets, the newspapers, and particularly, I want to point out the power of radio, because it's also a matter of scope. It's a strategy. You're trying to get your message across millions of people that maybe they do not have internet, but they do listen to radio. So you have to divide and conquer and take the message across many, many, many channels, as long as the message is the one powerful. And we were asking for freedom. We were asking for something that people could agree on, regardless on your political color. So when the moment came, we couldn't believe it. We were the first surprise when city after city, and using Facebook, Facebook mainly was the source of everybody who participated as an organizer. It was our crowdsourcer. It was our translator machine, our whatever we needed in terms of online activities, volunteerism. All we had to do was to ask, and people came from all over the world. We found Colombians in 200 cities, and actually this worldwide operation through social media is incredible. What Gmail can do for you, what Skype meeting can do for you, the instantaneity, the velocity on how information is spread in terms of logistics is crazy. It's crazy. So in February 4th, 2008, finally, the moment came and 12 million people were on the streets, and they were wearing the same white T-shirt with the same message, no more FARC. One message, 12 million T-shirts, 12 million people saying the same message. So it had an effect inside FARC as an organization. They felt the pressure, and during 2008, they freed more than 25 hostages because of the political pressure that civil society had inflicted. And then afterwards, many people that were fighters within FARC decided to quit. And then when they were asked, why did you quit? They said one of the reasons was the march. One of the reasons was that some people inside the jungle that really believe that FARC is Robin Hood and they are saints, and they're fighting for the good reasons, but this was like a reality check for all of them when they saw an entire country marching and demanding, please stop. Please don't kidnap us. Please don't kill us. And this is mainly what we achieve in Colombia. And ever since that moment, we've been training others on how to use the same tools. We're teaching other young activists. Particularly, I've spent my life in the last 4 years partnering with people like Talin, with people like all of the young leaders that are here. Because, you know, you can repeat and repeat the same mantras that they are the future, they are the future. But I like to think they are the ones actually doing it. Because you guys are not doing it. They are the ones doing it. So they need support. They need information. And actually, that's what I love to do with them. Thank you, Gordon.
So what you have heard from these three are what happens at a very high level, what takes place at a very human level, and a success story of young people who've changed their world using technology. What I'd like to do now is invite questions from the floor. And instead of doing it with questions from the floor at the end, I'd like the questions to come now. They can answer the questions, and then they can have a discussion or question among themselves, so we leave with their voices in our ears. The microphone is right here.
And what do we do?
And they'll ask a question, you'll answer it. And if you're a young leader, Please identify yourself as such.
Hi. Is this on? My name is Daniel Solomon. I'm a young leader from the United States, and so it's a privilege to have the opportunity to hear both David and Oscar give your perspectives. And obviously, I've spent a number of the past days interacting with Talon, but it's great to hear your presentation again. I have a question for Oscar and David, which is, it's easy in the context of this environment to imagine communications between individuals working on human rights, in the West and the United States and the UK and Canada, and individuals working to promote freedom in closed societies. But I'm wondering, how do we take those relationships back with us to our home countries? How do we, in the context of our day-to-day lives in the U.S. or in the U.K., imagine forming relationships between human rights advocates and cyber dissidents or, individuals working to sort of promote the use of these new technologies for social change in closed societies? Thank you.
From my experience, when you're an activist, it's very normal that the activist gets access to whether it's Washington institutions or UN and Organization of American States and different institutions that are worldwide and defend human rights or Human Rights Watch and stuff. So what you do back in your country, you can, from my experience, how it happens is that they won't listen to you unless in your own local community you already have something running, an organization in place. They won't buy your speech unless you're done. I mean, you need to show that inside your country you've done your homework so they can relate to you and actually assist you to continue that. And in order to do that, one of them by best practices, alliances, coalitions. Everybody wants to have their thunder, their moment of fame. But in activism, that's not the way it works. It works through different code, solidarity, compassion. So the same thing that happens to Venezuelans is the same thing that happens to Cubans, like an example, and so on. So one of the things that has helped is that instead of promoting my own cause, you don't see me promoting 1 million voices. You see me promoting my friends from Venezuela, my friends from Cuba, and from Iran, and from any other place that lives under tyranny, that they need attention. So doing that, you end up connecting with lots of things, and information gets into your ears. And that's the second stage. If you really want to be successful networking with others, get informed. Don't get the bias. Get the real information. From who? Not from newspapers. From people. That's why Twitter is so useful, because you're hearing it from the very single protagonist.
Just briefly, I would say that on an individual basis, there's a lot someone can do. The needs of dissidents are many. We get contacted every day by people who need different things. Some of it's legal help, some of it's editing, some of it's translation. And once you get into that process of dealing with actual people, like he's saying, you understand the plethora of needs. But I would say that probably the most important thing that an individual can do is to help frame a narrative in their home country. The Soviet Jewry movement did this extraordinarily well. Something similar to civic engagement on the issue of human rights, I mean, I think in America, the people who believe as we do, many of us on this panel, lost the narrative in large part in the Middle East. I think of a lost decade with Bashar al-Assad, everyone in the world is opposed to him today. But where were they when he was throwing bloggers in prison like Karim Arabji and Ahad al-Hindi and Osama Musa and lots of other people? But the narrative was that he might be good for peace. And if we could only hammer out a peace deal between Israel and Syria, everything would be okay, when the focus should have been on domestic human rights violations. And there's a lot that can be done in that sense. I used to host these protests at Egyptian and Syrian embassies and with other people, but in very small numbers, and I think back to that march in
1987 with 250,000 people to liberate Soviet Jews, and that was the kind of mass mobilization, mass engagement. And that was possible in part because you had people who were profoundly committed to the cause, and I fear that we have yet to inspire that kind of commitment to the cause when it comes to closed societies around the world. So that's possible, but it requires strategic thinking and understanding the way policy works and the fact that it's ultimately a reflection of a popular will.
Thank you.
I just want to add my voice about, particularly touching on what you said, Oscar, about how you need to be a credible organization before you can even start mobilizing
right.
and, you know, getting momentum for your cause. And considering that I started my own diplomatic consultancy, first of all, everyone's like, what's a diplomatic consultancy? We've never heard of it. Secondly, the kind of work that I do is bridging the gap between civil society and political leaders, which is also something quite bizarre with the fact that I work exclusively on the grassroots level with NGOs and individuals and civil society and not with corporations, but getting them closer to their political leaders, diplomats, embassies, who are often very much in, you know, behind closed doors and don't open up to the general public. And even though, I mean, branding and marketing yourself is incredibly important, you need to show people that you are credible. You know what you're talking about. You have the skills and knowledge to do what you're preaching you're going to do, as well as the connections. And networking is incredibly important for that. So whenever I do meet and when I do work with governments, government officials and political leaders, all of that is done face to face. But when I talk to my clients and project leaders, they're spread all over the world, and I have projects in India, Sudan, Nigeria, and I always forget the last one, the Pacific Islands. I mean, it's impossible for me to actually travel there and back to talk to them. And actually, in an internet age, I have no need to go all the way to the Pacific Island to talk about my project to, you know, these individuals, because we have Skype, we have the internet, we have Google. I've never had to go to those countries to discuss these projects because it can easily be done online. So I think it's all about utilizing the tools that we have to share ideas and to mobilize the kind of impact that you want to make. But it's also very important that you gain the right connections, you meet the right people, and you also brand yourself and your ideologies, whatever it is, to as a respectful person. Respected organization that people can actually agree to.
I'm sorry, brother. Can I add just one last remark? Because I heard several times David saying narrative, and it leads me to something even more than that. That is, when you already have a story to tell, you add it. Excuse me. You spice it with current information, because maybe the story is something that happened in the past. But then the best way to connect even more, to build your network, is to always be up to date with a story to tell that sells, engages, and you don't need to lie. You just need to show and amplify what he was commenting, the guy from Russia, the Gorbachev story.
Sharansky.
What's the pronunciation for that last name?
Sharansky.
So when you show that, and the only way to show reality in your country, to move people to support you, is by having somebody in the organization that is a good storyteller, so people can learn easily about the cause.
One of the things I just took away from this is, from the beginning, with this is a personal belief, unless you deal with fact and in context, you can be proven wrong, you can be proven to exaggerate, mm-hmm. you can be proven to mm-hmm. a liar, you can be proven to be ignorant if you don't have context. Mm-hmm. One of the things that is consistent with these three individuals is they always deal in fact. And what happens when that takes place is you get someone with an international reputation like Oscar. And I'll just, you know, I didn't read the thing, but David... He's written in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, Reuters, MSNBC, PBS, and Bloomberg TV. That's what makes a leader. Taking what you've got and going out and telling the story. And they have done it. More questions, I hope.
Good morning. My name is Sam Tota. I have a story, but it's 50 years back. But it will lead you. And the story I have is an answer to what Mr. Gordon asked a few minutes ago. What do we do? We act. And my story is, I was born in Syria. You had a choice today to have a man alive and speak to you, or a dead man who cannot speak. What did I do? So somebody acted on my behalf. My parents acted on my behalf. We got out of Syria and we remained in Turkey. Then I found out that I was stateless. And that doesn't even enter into the wording of the Conference on Human Rights. It says global. So that means the stateless are out of it. What did I do then?
I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'd like to keep these to questions, not stories of your... We only have a limited amount of time.
Okay.
Let's get to the question.
Well, the question is, you ask the question of what you do. You act. And by acting, you move. And acting means not only mentally acting, but physical acting. And to continue on the story, you meet the who is who. I went to Geneva to meet the High Commissioner for Refugees. That's acting. And the young people are asking, what can they do? They have to act. That means they have to connect.
But that's your opinion. I don't mean to interrupt you. That's exactly what these people are doing. They are the actors. And they are acting.
I think I would also like to add that even before acting, you have to think carefully before you act, because that's a lot. I mean, there's a lot of riots that's happening right now. I'm sure you're all familiar with the London riots that started. It started because someone was murdered, but then there was mass rioting and a lot of young people were looting and pretty much acting like hooligans, thinking that they could get away with these criminal acts. And they were doing this without thinking, they were just acting and doing. So I think it's important to keep a balance between thinking carefully before you act, but not acting bashfully.
But there's
and
also
just
more.
Doing anything.
There's also more, and in regards to what the gentleman said, in social media, you get a lot of things that might not be real. Like, oh yeah, if you go on Facebook and do this, you will succeed. It's not that fairy tale. It's not that easy. So what's going on right now is that causes are thinking, wrongly thinking, that all they need is followers. Mm. Wrong. Yeah. Followers, cool. You post something, you create engagement, you create awareness. That's the mission if you are creating awareness. But when you're organizing a mobilization, followers are useless. You need doers. So how to convert followers into doers is the leader's responsibility. That's it. Doers, not followers.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Miguel Bernard. I'm a lawyer. And my question is more out of curiosity. You speak about the personal connection of the movements. You show personal courage in what you do. I want to know your opinion, again, more out of curiosity, of online movements such as Anonymous and what they do that doesn't provide a face to their actions, and for better or for worse, has created a movement or a following. So, thank you.
Sure.
Actually, I have the same question for David.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you think I'm anonymous?
Go ahead, David.
No, that you are familiar with it, and I like to know.
No comment. No. I think that groups that get to the heart of the matter, that search for truth, are generally good. My fear is that sometimes they don't differentiate between good governments and bad governments. So leaking secrets of the United States, in my opinion, is generally not a good thing. If that is focused on Bashar al-Assad's Syria, or China, North Korea, that can provide a profoundly good movement. I think that in the human rights community, there's been a lack of recognition of the vast gulf between open and closed societies. And some of these groups that make no such distinction, that attack everyone equally, miss the point. Because in open societies like America and Canada, and democracies across the world, there's such a vibrant civil society, there's such a free press, not without its problems. It has major problems, and that's why whistleblowers can provide a very valuable service. But at the same time, my fear is that some of these groups lump everyone in the same category. All governments are evil. Anybody with power is evil. And while right. power has the ability to corrupt, one can never, ever forget the vast, enormous, indeed unbridgeable gulf between open and closed societies. And so I'm skeptical of such groups, even though at times they may provide a benefit. But I'd be curious to hear other people's opinions as well.
Well, I know there's a lot of online petitions like Avaaz and Anonymous and everything. I worked in the House of Commons before. And as a caseworker, we received millions and millions of emails from these online petitions. I mean, it's very easy for someone to just go on these websites and click, yes, I support this petition, and I add my name and my country to this particular issue. But on the political side, unfortunately, it doesn't mean anything because it's a numbers game. So you get 1 million people or 100 billion people adding their voice to these particular issues, but just by signing a petition, unfortunately, on the political side, it doesn't add anything. It's just pretty much, okay, so which one of these campaigns have the most amount of numbers? We'll deal with it later. And it just gets put on a back burner, and we didn't really effectively use these online petition campaigns to actually do anything on the political side. So I think from my perspective, it was a little bit ineffective.
No, there is a saying that you talk about the party depending on how you spend the party. So Anonymous is many things for me. If you tell me Anonymous, the first thing that comes into my mind is Tunisia, how great it was for them, how great in January 2011, the work that they did, disclosing all this information. But just because Tunisian's government was cracking down on internet, right? And censorship was all over the place, the same that applied to the Mubarak regime in Egypt during the before being ousted. So Anonymous comes like a breaker of censorship. But David is completely right, right? They had the chance to remain neutral or at least smart, and they didn't. So something that had a good intention got corrupted in the middle. Not that it's completely gone. Actually, Anonymous still does very interesting things. So in my case, I just follow what they do, but I filter what they do. I mean, it's not like a religion, right? It's not like everything they do you have to agree with. No, not necessarily. That's it.
You want to add anything?
No, I think. He agreed with me, so I agree with him.
Please, I just want to draw, if it's coming up, there's a huge difference, and I'll speak in my opinion. There's a huge difference, as David said, between open societies and closed societies. And sometimes that difference gets blurred in these conferences where theories take over. The realities are out there. And if you don't make those distinctions, your ability to make progress using these technologies becomes limited because you don't deal with the facts and you don't deal with the context.
Right, exactly. That's it.
Meera Kamdar, I was a speaker yesterday in the foreign policy panel. I don't know how many of you heard my remarks, but this distinction between open and closed societies is a very important one, but it's not always such a clear distinction. No. And in some of what I said yesterday about India, where there are real threats to freedom of expression going on right now, I don't know how many of you read the opinion in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago by Suketu Mehta, who's a journalist, professor of journalism at NYU and the author of Bombay Maximum City. The title of his opinion on the state of free expression in India was called Speech Impediments. And the internet is a particularly contested area in India. They have the Internet Technology Act that they passed a few years ago, and which is used to control freedom of expression on the internet in all kinds of ways by the government at all kinds of levels. One of the more regrettable incidents that many of us have written about recently was when Bal Thackeray, the leader of the Shiv Sena, a party which is a right-wing regionalist party in Bombay, was on his last legs. He died recently. There was a lot of fear in the city that there would be mass violence when he died. And a 20-year-old girl posted something on Facebook saying, I don't understand why just like this guy, one person dying, we have to shut down the whole city. And her friend liked it. Within 2 hours, they were arrested. And the young woman who had posted this fairly anodyne remark on Facebook's uncle's eyeglasses shop was completely wrecked by the police. This is in a country that's trumpeted as being one of the great democracies, and it is a great democracy. It is a functioning democracy in a lot of ways. But, you know, there are also a lot of disturbing threats to speech, and I'll just restrict it because this goes for novelists, painters, and all. So the question is, how do you, when you are, like, you have a project in India, for example, or in your projects, I just think it's important for those of us who work and live in democracies and between different democracies to, you know, not, to realize that the world isn't always just black and white, that there are areas of gray, and that as citizens of democracies, one of our first duties is to make sure that our democracies remain zones of free speech.
Those black and white cookies are delicious, though. You know, those. So sometimes black and white. But of course, what you're saying is right. It's there's so many countries in the middle. Countries regress all the time. There are countries that take two steps forward, one step back. But I stand by the remark that I think it's a duty of the human rights community to point out eternally the differences between democracies and dictatorships. Mm-hmm. And of course, there need to be robust efforts inside countries that are in the middle to push them in the right direction. But when I see things like calling, prisons, Guantanamo, the gulag of our time, I can't help but, I mean, it's such a grotesque comparison between a system that enslaved tens of millions of people and brought unmitigated horror to literally millions of people, to compare that with a prison system which is far from perfect, which needs improvement. But the comparison, I don't think, can be made. And when major human rights organizations spend a majority of time on countries that have free press, that have independent judiciaries, that have free and fair elections, and they say, yeah, we'll get to Bashar al-Assad later. We'll get to countries like Saudi Arabia later that forbids women from leaving the home or country without a man's permission. While, of course, it's true that there are countries in the middle, I think that there's a profound moral distinction that needs to be made, and it is the duty of human rights organizations to never, ever, ever forget that.
Are there any further questions? Then I'd like to leave this group, if you would just have a discussion between yourselves specifically on the point that you've left off on. And that is something, Teddy? This is the gentleman, by those who don't know, who really brought technology to this conference, and through him, the young leaders used technology, Skype, internet, and they was the best prepared young leaders group we had. Thank you, Teddy.
Not a problem. So I guess I don't have to introduce myself. Thanks, Gordon. And my question is really about this notion of anonymity and identity on the internet.
Very important.
And where we are going in terms of human rights. For a very long time, internet society has now afforded itself, has had voice and has felt empowered because of their anonymity, because there is no repercussion to the person for what it is that you have to say. So, and this empowers hate speech online. You basically, there are no repercussions. I'm anonymous. Anybody I can say whatever it is I want. And then on the other hand, you have companies like Google who are forcing real name assignments, in order to use their services. We all know there's a commercial need for that. For them, because what they do, you're a product, you're signing up as a product, so they can sell to their marketers. So my question is, where is the line drawn in terms of giving up our identity to these companies that own these massive services that offer us the ability to voice our opinion and platforms, and that of privacy. Where is the balance? We have to give up something to get something. We want accountability online, but we don't want to give up privacy. Where do we draw the line?
Can I start with this one?
No.
I always feel like as human rights and as citizens of a nation, you partly give up your sovereignty because as citizens, you know, we expect our governments to look after us, to give us, you know, health benefits and social benefits. And I think the same applies online as well. When you're part of Facebook, for example, you have to tick a little box with their terms and conditions, and a lot of it is you're pretty much giving up your sovereignty on Facebook, and it's not like you're completely anonymous. You're not, because you're adding your date of birth, you're adding your name, your country, where you're from, and all of this personal information so that companies can actually start targeting and marketing to you and to your preferences. And that's one of the sovereignty rights of sovereignty we just give away to these companies, because in order to be part of this community, you have to tick that little box, and without ticking that box, you can't be, you can't be online with these companies. And I think although we're anonymous to the point that we can say what we want, and unfortunately, a lot of the times there is absolutely no repercussion. So, you know, just because I post something, a blog post maybe, and someone writes something really nasty about what I've said, I can't chase that person and ask them what they meant and ask them to elaborate or anything. They're gone. As soon as they post that message, they're gone. They're a faceless person to me. But on Facebook, for example, companies use your privacy, your personal information, and sell it on to other companies. So it is a mixture between being anonymous and being and freely giving out your personal information.
I have a completely different view, and can I do just to both of you a reality check? When it comes to causes, it has nothing to do with your life, personal life. Excuse me. When it comes to causes, what is at risk, what is at stake, is really serious. We're dealing about the freedom of Cuba. We're dealing about the future of Venezuela, 28 million people, right? So let's say that you have that problem. Just have it in mind that it's really serious. So what does it take for an activist to lead a cause that size? Somebody with courage. That's all it takes. And then you put that guy on a plaza, he will behave one way. You put that guy on Facebook, he will behave the same way. Because it's not about privacy, it's about what you plan to say. So you go online, and of course you show your face. And somebody will tell you to your ear, don't do it, they can kill you. So, you know, in the end, when you're dealing about activism, I mean, this discussion is good if we were in advertising week, but we are in Global Conference for Human Rights. So we're dealing with the freedom of entire countries. And we are promoting leaders to show up. So privacy, really, the conversation becomes irrelevant when actually you're saying to the leader, show yourself, speak up, show your voice like Giovanni Sanchez in Cuba did on Twitter. And by doing that, you should know that you could get killed, arrested, tortured, and censured. But still, we want you to do it. That's what we're asking our leaders, young leaders, to do, to speak up and step up. So, of course, you cannot hide behind a mask. Actually, the what works, and this is by experience, in Colombia, the 1 Million Voices protest worked just because the media and all the people who wanted to know who was behind that, we were public. They could find us. So then, reading you, because I understand your concerns. So what you do online is that you have to strategize you. You have family, you have pictures to protect. So what applies there is common sense. I mean, I won't share online what I don't want other people to see, just I don't publish it. And I really find, I honestly laugh about people complaining and crying because the family vacation is now public. And then why did you post it in the first place? And why did you make it public? I mean, don't be silly. Common sense, common sense, common sense. So in my particular case, I have two different worlds. One is my Facebook for my family, and then my public statements and my public life happens on Twitter, because Twitter is the public platform. Facebook is just for my friends.
Yeah,
so if you strategize, you won't have any issue. Then what you're dealing with is not if somebody watches your vacation in whatever you had it, is, oh my God, FARC is after me. Al-Qaeda is going to chase me. They know who my family is. So a good activist, what he tries to do is to protect family members and to protect information that they don't need to know. So don't show off too much. It's the rule of the standard.
David, could you address that at a different level? At the level that you're working at, how do you draw the distinction between public and private, and how do you use the technologies specifically at the level you're working at?
Sure. I think Oscar makes a lot of good points, and it relates to that, and it gets back to the initial discussion about open and closed societies. I think when people think of internet freedom in America and Canada, there are these very important, very complex questions of privacy come up, and what is the responsibility of a organization like a company like Google? And for us, we can discuss it in a very academic way, because these are important academic questions. What information should you give over to a company, and what responsibility do they have to keep that private? But I think so long as it's left in the hands of individual choice, that we know what we're getting into, we are ultimately responsible. Like Oscar says, you either post your pictures or you don't. You don't even have to use the platform. It's not some mandatory thing that everyone has to be on Facebook. You don't have to be on Facebook. You don't have to be on Twitter. You can live your life as privately as you want, even in today's age, presuming that you aren't seduced by what is so incredible, that is, namely, to have all the world's information immediately accessible at your fingertips. So this is sort of the trade-off, and we can be smart about here. When it comes to the countries that I work in, it's a very different question, because then you're dealing with real life and death issues. Either, some people. I think a lot has changed, though, in recent years, I have to say. When I first got into this, the idea that there were a lot of anonymous users doing activism was a lot more prevalent than I hear about it today. I think, in large part, the wall of fear has fallen. There's so much out there publicly, especially in the Middle East, that I think that Egyptian activists today are much bolder than they were in 2007 and 8. Mm-hmm. And again, in large part, in conversing with individuals, you have to tailor it to their individual case. But I will say that more often than not, I've seen that people want to be more public. The question also relates to publicity in the West. Some people say, no, I don't want my name mentioned by someone like, Bush or Obama because of X, Y, or Z. I can't tell you how many conversations I've had where people say, my husband, my father, my son is in prison. Can you help get this on the international scene? Can you make people talk about it? Can you bring it up at the UN? Can you have diplomats around the world raise their names? I've had Syrian activists say that, the happiest day of their life was when their name was mentioned by the leader of the free world, because it meant that there was a chance that they would get out, that they would be safe. And so I'm generally in favor of bringing more publicity rather than relying on the anonymity, even though there are cases where it's really important, where things like Tor and anonymizers are exceedingly important to keep activity in those countries safe. But on the level of dissidents, I think that the more publicity and the more press we bring to individuals on the front line, the safer they will be, and the better, in the end, we all will be.
I want to thank the three of you. I'm sorry?
Oh, I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were telling me to be quiet. Come here.
Not now.
You almost look like my wife.
I'm Sandra Iguinode. I'm a student at the Faculty of Law. So my question is, I'm a Nigerian Canadian, and on the one hand, you have countries that actually care about cyber dissidents and trying to suppress them. Then on the other hand, you have countries that don't think that it's as important. So in the case of Nigeria, there's no law trying to suppress cyber dissidents. There's no talk about cyber dissidents. Yet everyone in Nigeria has three cell phones. They are online. They tweet. They're on Facebook. And you have diaspora communities blogging about issues on a daily basis. I mean, I'm a part of it. But yet, it seems that the government just doesn't care. So I'm just wondering what your thoughts are regarding ways to move forward on that front. You have these countries that are, I mean, Nigeria is, you know, to some extent a democracy. And people talk online, and we have, the internet is a useful tool in terms of talking about issues of democracy or human rights and whatever. But
I got you. I take the question. In cases where the country does not provide the elements or the ingredients, let's say, for example, you heard when I told the account of 1 Million Voices story in Colombia that we needed traditional media. And we could do that because in Colombia we do have a free media. Free by me is this bias, but still this free. Anybody can say whatever news. But my point is that in places like Nigeria, where you don't have that. And worse, you have a government that is lazy or deaf. Most of the times, just deaf. Doesn't hear, yeah, you make it a protest. You make whatever rally inside the country, but it doesn't work. So here it comes another area, another field is strategy, marketing, political strategy. So besides being an activist, now you have to be a strategic thinker. And then say, okay, we don't have that. So you think like a general in a war. So how do I circumvent that situation? In your case, the first thought that popped into my mind was diaspora. That the problem that you have is that in Nigeria, you don't have people that are connected because there is no internet, the cell phones are too expensive. But you are Nigerian, and you're here, and you have internet. So try to find all the people like you and create the pressure from the outside in. That's the one recommendation, among many others that you could find in the way. But always think that you cannot break reality. You have to strategize depending on what you have.
Do you want to add anything to
that? Just a quick word. Again, Oscar makes a very good point, and it reminds me of the first question about what we can all do. People in this room have expertises in different fields, maybe government, maybe politics, maybe journalism, maybe human rights, maybe writing, maybe editing, maybe legal expertise. And one of the things we can do is engage diaspora communities and try and help bring in expertise, because for as brave as many of these people are, God knows they are not strategic thinkers. Sometimes they're not even tactical thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's good, because you just need a lightning rod to just shake things up. But there also really needs to be very careful, smart consideration, learning from different fields. I mean, these people are, look, you know, Václav Havel was a poet and a playwright, you know, and he wasn't a professional activist, but he had a keen sense of, I guess, what worked in retrospect. But a lot of people are just average people, some of whom are extremely brave, but they don't know how the world works. They definitely don't know how politics works. You know, talking with a dissident about how to change American policy is oftentimes a laughable experience, you know. Either it's some crazy concocted conspiracy about how if you only talk to this person, then everything will change. They just don't know. Some of it's ignorance and some of it's misconceptions. But I think that if we can kind of collectively bring our expertise to people, particularly in strategic thinking. And, of course, you need the domestic expertise. You can't. It's obvious. I was at a Google thing one time where somebody was one of the chief bloggers for Obama was giving a presentation to a whole group of cyber activists from the Middle East, and another Google person chewed him out and said, "You've no idea what they're going through. You're talking about how to get the word out in Tampa and D.C. and New York, but it doesn't even apply to countries like Syria." And there's definitely truth to that. So somewhere in between, I have no idea where, but there's a line where we can take the expertise that we know and fuse it with real domestic experts and try and affect change.
Listen, just one last, and it's easy. You hear this and you still get, I have no idea where to start. Video. When we're discussing here social media, don't take that as a fairy tale. Use it. Simple. A YouTube video where you can actually teach the world about Nigeria and what's going on. Because it will mean, it actually has the same effect as 1 million tweets. One YouTube video that is seen 50,000 times has the same political effect than 1 million retweets. So, and you get that forever. I mean, the video, nobody will take it away. You can tell people, oh, you want to know about my country? Go here, and in 5 minutes, I promise that you will understand. Because video has that power. But who's going to pay for it? Who's going to do it? You. Because it takes one mind, one courage guy, one courage girl, to guy with courage, to make the decision to start, like I did when I pushed the button and I created the 1 million voices page without knowing the outcome. I just trusted that I was doing the right thing. That's it.
Well, if there are no more questions, if there are any, we've got time for one more, maybe two at the most. If not, then I'm going to thank you all very, very much for a very informative panel. I come away with this panel with the feeling that it takes knowledge, again, it takes fact, it takes courage, and above all, one size does not fit all. And so if you're going to start as young leaders, you've got to start with the facts. You've got to know where you are along the lines of democracy, effective human rights. You have a tool at your disposal, which is your weapon. It's not lethal, but it can have incredibly positive effects, because I think naturally, generally, people want to do what is right. And I thank you people for being here. I think you've all done what is right. Thank you.